And it is an enormous joy for us today to have Matthew Fox with us. Matthew has been an important voice for the planet and an important voice for progressive thought within the Catholic wing of the Christian Church for many, many years. Many of us have had the opportunity of spending time with him this weekend, and I think none of us who have been able to do that have left that without being changed in some way. And I'm sure that that will also be true this morning. So, Matthew, I welcome you to our pulpit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you for your leadership here at this church, which is obviously alive and kicking. And I agree with you that the readings are, as you put it, unduly somber today. The gospel we just heard is pretty wild about the stars falling and all the rest, and things coming to an end. That literature is called apocalyptic literature. And actually, the scholars, New Testament scholars today, believe that this gospel does not contain the words of Jesus, that this was written after Jesus lived. It contains the words of the early church. And I want to remind you that the early church had the courage and the creativity to make up all kinds of good words and put them into Jesus' mouth. A lot of the Gospels is made of that stuff. I ask, where has that creativity gone? Where has that courage gone? And of course, one theme in this Gospel we just read is the theme about being awake, being awake, being awake. Don't sleep through life. Be awake. That is a call to warriorhood. No warrior can afford to be asleep. And the early church was urging itself to stay awake, to be alert, to develop their warriorhood. And I think that this theme, now I've been asked to speak to the theme of the art of hope. And I think this theme of apocalyptic feeling is alive in our time today. It is a sign of our times. There are all kinds of movies about it. There are TV shows about it. There are kind of weird things about it, like vampire addiction and stuff like that. But it's already saying the same thing, that people are sensing, maybe not thinking, but feeling, like kind of end times, that our institutions are failing us across the board. Education and politics and religion and media and economics, for sure. And of course, peacemaking seems edgy and all the rest. So the archetypal invitation to enter into the darkness and to entertain despair is, it seems to me, more relevant today than it has been in my entire life of 76 years. So what is this art of hope? I think we should dwell a little bit first on its opposite. This is one way to approach a spiritual concept, is to go to its opposite first. For example, if you want to know what justice is, get attuned to injustice. Pay attention to injustice, and that will give you a hint at what justice might be. And so, to turn to hope, let's first spend a little time meditating on despair, its opposite. Now, Thomas Aquinas says that, who thought and taught and fought in the 13th century, pre-modern thinker and a genius in every way, he says that despair is born of fear. And I think it's one reason that despair is so in the air today is that we've been fed fear, at least since 9/11, on a daily basis by our media, by our politicians. We've been swimming in a milieu of fear. And now I think it's gone to the next level. Now we're swimming in a milieu of despair. Every place I go, I told the group this weekend, I was with 150 scientists for a week this summer on an island off of New Hampshire. And these scientists were all in despair. It was just in the air. Some of it was kind of personal because they felt, I think, that their grants were going to die given the current anti-scientific administration. But I think it was bigger than that. They're very worried about the future of the planet. And they have the facts to be worried. And they're not in denial. Frankly, I think anyone who's alive today and awake is feeling a certain amount of despair. These are not happy times. Aquinas says that despair is the most dangerous of all sins. He says the worst of sin is injustice, but the most dangerous is despair, because when despair takes over our souls, we don't care about ourselves. And certainly we don't care about others. I was actually at a retreat center this past year, and there was a parallel retreat going on. I was in one room, and this fellow was in another. And I had never heard of him before, but he had a pretty good crowd there, about 35 people. So driving me to the airport, I asked the fellow who drove me, who was that fellow, and what's his pitch? He said, this guy, who's half my age probably, I'd say in his 40s, he's teaching people that it's all over. Our democracy's over, and our species is done, and the planet as we know it is over. So just live, drink, and be merry. That is his message. And the guy's selling books, and he's holding retreats about how to, well, that's one way of responding to despair, is just yield to it. Take it for a ride right to the end. That's not my way, and I don't think it's the gospel way. Despair is about the impossible. It's about sensing and feeling that things are impossible. Hope is about the possible. Hope is about the possible and how we expand ourselves. Aquinas says the worst thing a human being can do is to teach despair. The worst thing we can do. That means the worst thing the media can do is to teach despair. And the worst thing our politicians can do is to teach despair. So then, how's the way out? What about this art called hope? Otto Rank, one of the great thinkers of the 20th century, he was, as you may know, the youngest in Freud's original circle, and the brightest. Everyone knew he was the brightest, including Freud. But he broke with Freud and went his own way. And he really is the father of humanistic psychology. Maslow, Rollo May, Carl Rogers admit that they stand on the shoulders of Otto Rank. But because Rank is vilified by his Freudian brothers, few people really know him. They were so vicious against him that they wrote his publisher, Knopf, in New York, and said, if you publish any books by Otto Rank, you won't get any books from Sigmund Freud. That's pretty dirty play there. But there's nothing like the reptilian brain unleashed. Even among psychologists. Well, Freud had a word for it, fratricide, didn't he? But here's an observation by Rank. He says, pessimism comes from a repression of creativity. Pessimism comes from a repression of creativity. To me, that means wherever patriarchy reigns, wherever the divine feminine has been repressed, we are inviting pessimism into our hearts, our minds, our schools, our culture in all of its aspects. Patriarchy, by definition, is pessimistic. That's why it loves original sin. And its capitalist counterpoint, consumerism. You have to prove you're saved by the amount of money you can show off, or the power. It was Carl Jung who said that creativity comes from the realm of the mothers, the realm of the mothers. So is this bringing back the feminine to its rightful place, both in our understanding of divinity and our understanding of ourselves, and therefore in our understanding of education and politics and economics and medicine and religion. It is there that there is an opening for creativity. The best definition I know of hope comes from David Orr, the eco-philosopher. He says, hope is a verb with the sleeves rolled up. Hope is a verb with the sleeves rolled up. Hope isn't about optimism. Hope isn't about not paying attention to the facts, as dire and apocalyptic as they may be. Hope is about going to work, rolling up our sleeves, and working not out of an action, reaction, or reptilian brain response, but working out of a deeper place inside of us, the place where possibility emerges, the place where creativity catches fire. Creativity matters. Creativity matters. One of my favorite stories comes from the cosmologist Brian Swim. And he told me this years ago. He said, you know, when humans left Africa, we had discovered fire and all that about 65,000 years ago. So we went wandering and searching and all over the place as we are. And a bunch of people ended up in what is now Eurasia. And just about then, the Ice Age broke out. Now think about this. Our ancestors come from Africa, the savannas, the heat, and all that. And all of a sudden, we're in a 10,000-year period of ice. Now, I'm sure the first 1,000 years, we were blaming each other who turned off the lights. Right? But meanwhile, we had a hustle. Our ancestors had a hustle. They had to learn real fast how to kill a mastodon. What are these things called? These big mastodon, thank you, and skin it. And take on the wild-toothed saber tigers and hide in caves and tell stories at night. There was no TV. And all of it. And they did it. They pulled it off. But that proves two things to me. Never underestimate the creativity of our species when it comes down to the issue of survival. That's when things kick in. That's when the Holy Spirit wants to take over. Things have to fall apart. As my mentor, Père Chaloux, a French Dominican, used to say, if you want omelets, you must break the eggs. Well, apocalyptic times are about the eggs breaking. Now, we can choose to go that one route of just enjoying ourselves selfishly till we die out, or we can go the route of our ancestors, which is to get our act together and start creating things, making things new again. Hope is a verb with the sleeves rolled up. Meister Eckhart asked, why is there so little creativity? What holds people back from their creativity? And he says, it is lack of trust. Lack of trust in oneself and in the spirit. Because creativity is a task of co-creating. We work with the Holy Spirit when we create. As I talked about the other day, the angels are part of this. Intuition. We call them muses. The angels show up to help us to co-create. And the Spirit flows through us. Thomas Aquinas says, the same Spirit that hovered over the waters at the beginning of creation, we might translate that to the fireball at the beginning of creation, the same Spirit hovers over the mind of the artist at work. And that is all of us. We are all artists because we are all made in the image and likeness of the Creator. Isaiah's reading today that we are all the clay in the potter's hands. Aquinas says, God is the artist of artists. The artist, he uses that name for God time and again. I think it may be his favorite name for God. The artist of artists. And he says, how can an artist, he says, every artist loves what they give birth to. The poet loves her poetry. The painter loves his painting. The potter loves her pots. How can God, who is the artist of everything, hate anything? That's where we tap in to the roots of our creativity. It's all about love. Now, years ago, I was part of a conference at the Schumacher Lecture Series in Bristol, England. And the first speaker was Lester Brown of the World Watch Institute. And he got up and he talked about the demise of our planet. And he said, we have 20 years left to change our ways. By the way, that was 23 years ago. Yes, it was. And then he ended his talk saying this, the number one obstacle to the environmental revolution, he said, is apathy. And then he sat down. It was my time to talk. Well, it was a great inroad for me. I didn't know he was going to end that way. But apathy, see, is one of the capital sins. In the Middle Ages, it was called acedia, A-C-E-D-I-A. We've mistranslated as sloth. That's how we know it as a capital sin. But that translation is very narrow. It came from the Industrial Revolution. It came from the capitalist owners of the Industrial Revolution who thought you were slothful if you weren't happy working 12-hour days, 6 days a week, and also if you were 12 years old doing the same. That was pre-union understanding of acedia, sloth. In fact, what acedia means, Aquinas says acedia is a lack of energy to begin new things. The lack of energy to begin new things. So it is apathy. And it is depression. And it is despair. And it is quitting. What's the medicine for acedia and apathy? Aquinas says zeal comes. Zeal is the opposite of acedia. Zeal is the energy to begin new things. Zeal comes, he says, from an intense experience of the beauty of things. An intense experience of the beauty. It's about falling in love all over again. Now, with our anthropocentric and narcissistic worldview, we think falling in love is about finding a two-legged mate until death do you part. Good luck. That's a blessing to have in your life. But believe me, falling in love is a cosmic thing. It's about falling in love with the elephants and the polar bears and the tigers and the rainforests and the whales and the oceans and the rivers and the soil and all the beings that we share this amazing and unrepeatable planet with. And of course, with one another and those who are different from us. And with music, and with poetry, and with dance, and architecture, and all the other glories that human creativity has bestowed on us. That's the answer to despair, falling in love again. I say, if you don't fall in love three times a day, you're not awake. You're not awake. Now, with 2 trillion galaxies, you could fall in love with a galaxy every day. And there would be billions left over, virginal galaxies when you die. You can fall in love with wildflowers. There's no limit. That's the medicine for acedia. That's the medicine for giving up. Well, there's a wonderful teaching about hope from a wonderful American writer. His name, some of you I'm sure know him, is Scott Russell Sanders. He wrote a book called Hunting for Hope, A Father's Journeys. And the story goes like this. First of all, Sanders is an ecological writer, so he's been writing for decades about the demise of the planet and all this stuff that's going on. So he took a 17-year-old son out for a camping trip, just the two of them. They were going to bond like never before. It's going to be the highlight of their relationship. They went out camping, and there was this big blow-up. His 17-year-old son said to him, Dad, will you quit talking about your fears, about your despair? I'm sick and tired of hearing about the end of the earth. Don't you have any hope at all? Sanders was absolutely shocked. He didn't know this is where his son was at. So what he did was he took a 2-year sabbatical. He's kind of a privileged guy. I don't know how you can pull that off. I guess his books sell better than mine do. But anyway, he took it 2 years off, and then he wrote this book, Hunting for Hope, A Father's Journeys. And I want to share with you just a few small passages of it, because I think it nails what hope is all about. He says, I still hanker for the original world, the one that makes us, rather than the one we make. A hunger for contact with the shaping power that curves the comet's path and fills the owl's throat with song and fashions every flake of snow and carpets the hills with green. It is a prodigal, awful, magnificent power, forever casting new forms into existence, then tearing them apart and starting over. Obviously, he's waking up to the cosmos. He's waking up to the cosmic Christ, the Buddha nature, the presence of the glory, the dots of the divine in all being, and certainly in our universe as a whole. And he talks about this mystical experience he had, though he doesn't use that word, driving down the road one night. I climbed out of the car with a greeting on my lips, but the sky hushed me. From the black bowl of space, countless fiery lights shone down, each one a sun or a swirl of suns, the whole brilliant host of them, enough to strike me dumb. You see, he became attuned again to the the vastness and the glory of our universe and of the darkness, as well as the light. I remember an Aboriginal in Australia teaching me one day, he said, you know, the daytime is for seeing particulars, one another and the other species and so forth, but the nighttime is for seeing the universe. Because the darkness is there, and then you can pick up the light of the stars and so forth. And Sanders says that, what is it we need faith in, he says, in our capacity for decent and loving work, in the healing energy of wildness, in the holiness of creation. This is what we need to believe in. Nature is full of genius, Thoreau said, full of the divinity, so that not a snowflake escapes its fashioning hand. That the universe exists at all, says Sanders, that it obeys laws, that those laws have brought forth galaxies and stars and planets, and on our planet at least, life, and out of life consciousness, and out of consciousness these words, this breath. This is a chain of wonders. A chain of wonders. I dangle from that chain and hold on tight. That's hope. That's the origin of hope. Dangle from that chain of wonders, hold on tight, and start kicking ass. Make yourself loud and present and tap into your moral outrage. This latest so-called tax bill that will throw millions off of Medicare, and it's just the first step in killing Medicare and Medicaid, etc. If we don't stand up, then we are teaching despair. If our hope does not show itself in action, and action can be of diverse kinds, there's no one action. Maybe you're a poet, maybe you're a painter, maybe you're a singer, maybe you're a journalist. How you express your moral outrage is your call, literally. But that hope is about action, action from the heart to defend what you cherish. That is, it seems to me, the lesson of today's reading. And Isaiah begins, "Oh, tear the heavens open and come down." I think that's why this reading was chosen for Advent, the coming. Tear the heavens open. Well, you see, that's the language and the picture put forward in Jesus' baptism, that the heavens open up, and there is this voice, "Listen to my beloved." And the same scene is repeated in the Transfiguration. Each of these experiences is named here in these cosmic Christ stations. The Transfiguration, too. The heavens open up. Well, this is the answer to apocalypse. Because apocalypse does not just mean the end times, it also means revelation. There are two sides to the word apocalypse in the scriptures. It means the end times, but it also means the unveiling, the revelation. This moment of history, which is riddled with discouragement and darkness, is also an invitation to step up to the plate about the next stage of evolution of our species. This new paradigm in which we can swim, where we realize that all of nature is grace, that the universe itself is a primary sacrament, and all of the sacraments take their power and their beauty from that sacrament. And we can no longer take it for granted. We must do what Samuel did, stop our cars and go out in the night and ask the night what it has to teach us. What is the revelation that is coming through in all this suffering, but also in all this possibility that beckons us? There, I think, lies the art of hope. Maybe someday they will look back on our generation and say we were the hopesters. Not hipsters, but hopesters. Thank you.